the Shiras HaKesubah, the reason it has nothing to do with Thanksgivings, if you've scratched your heads to figure out any connection activities, there is none. But just because we're learning Ksubas in Yeshiva, I want to go through a little bit something that's very much part of our life. And now, the topic was, what exactly to promise your wife? Let me tell you that next time, don't sign on something unless you know what you're signing on. If you need to find out now what you promised, that's a little late. But Al Kapanim...
there are people who are not married yet.
There are people not married yet. Okay, good. And the irony is we don't sign. Bidar Klal, some people have a custom to sign. In Halacha, a signature on a contract is not. It's Edim witnessing a Kenyan. So let me go over and sort of encapsulate what the Rambam says, for those of you who didn't have time to learn. Just encapsulate it, and then we'll get a sense of what our Ksuba looks like and how it reflects it. The Rambam, and once again, the Rambam is always a summation of the Gemara. Sometimes that requires a certain weighing of things, but it's not as if the Rambam is mechadish all these things. The Rambam is just simply, it's just a very, very convenient way of summing up the Gemara. Chazal made a takana that when a woman gets married, there are certain obligations of the husband to the wife. The Torah obligates certain things. The Torah says, Sher ksus vonoso lo yigra, that you have to buy food, clothing, and conduct normal physical relations. That the Torah said. That's the only part that's clear in the Torah. There is another word used in the Torah. It says mohab psulim, kemora psulim. It says if somebody is, either forces a woman or seduces a woman who's a psula, he has to pay her a fine that's equivalent to mohab psulas, which literally means dowry of a psula. Some take that to mean that that's a sort of obligation. The Torah is hinting at that, and that would mean that there's a certain amount that we'll call a dowry of sorts that is obligatory, and many shittas hold, most shittas probably hold not, that it is not obligatory. The Torah did not require that. The Torah only required sheksus v'nasa. The Chachamim, seeing that husbands have a tendency to lose it and get upset and divorce their wives very easily, which is not good, they decided to put a speed bump and make it a little bit more difficult. Nothing works as well as money. And so when you get married, if you divorce your wife or if you die, she has a sum of money which was called 200 zuz. That is ksuva. 200 zuz, that's the main part of ksuva. It's meant to be. It's meant to be the amount of money that roughly was a year's worth of parnasa. You could live on a very, very low standard of life for a year. So it means A, it's an impediment for him to divorce her, even if he flies off his handle. But money is money. Secondly, if God forbid she becomes an almana, she has some support. She can take from the estate straight off that amount of money. The 200 zuz is halachically, it's the amount of money that determines whether you're a pauper or not. In terms of collecting tzedakah, 200 zuz is the cutoff amount. And that's roughly, it was equivalent in those years to what the person needed for a year to live on. For those who like gematrias, tzedakah is gematria 199, and this is one more than tzedakah. If somebody has only 199, you can give him as much money in one shot. The minute he has 100, 200, he's not at stock a case, and that's the halacha, that's the cutoff point. So they made a takana of ksuba 200. They also added that an almana or a grusha, a divorcee or an almana that got married, gets 100. That's the main part of the ksuba. So the Rambam said was that when so the Rambam says when you get married, you now become obligated in a bunch of things. One is this ksuba. Then there's, if we took a look on page 2 and 3, there's a whole list of, let's go through very briefly, Beis and Gimel. Beis and Gimel. It says, Kishenose Adam Isha Bein Psula Bein Bula Bein Derla Bein Ktana. If you marry anyone, in other words, you make the transition from Erisin to Nesuin. In the old days, we do it today also, except we do it without a time gap. You first say Hariat Mekudeshes, that's stage one in marriage. At that point, you are married, you're not going to live with anyone else, and so on. You need a get. And then when you do the Nesuin, which is the Chuppah, the Yichud, that's the full marriage, and that's called Nesuin. So the Rambam here says, when you do that Nesuin, Yischayev Basar Dvarim, you become obliged in 10 things. V'yiskev arba dvarim, and you receive 4. In other words, Chazal wanted to create a structure for a common financial setup. The husband bears more of responsibilities, obviously. He traditionally was able to work more. He was stronger, and it was his business to have more input, and he gets back as a sort of the Chazal want to be fair, they sort of gave back 4 elements. Vasara, of those 10 items that he's obliged, Shloish Menat Torah, there are 3 Menat Torah, She'era is food, Ksusa is clothing, Onasa is to live with her as normal. Vashiva Medivrei Seifrim, and there are 7 things that he is obliged to provide for her, rabbinic obligation. V'kulat nai bezn hei. Kulat nai bezn is a critical word. It means whether he obligated himself and he actually said, I'm giving it. Or even if he did nothing, tnai bezn means it automatically, it's statutory. Whether you spoke about it, agreed to it, whatever it is, that clicks in automatically. That's an important thing to remember. So these 7 things are going to be automatic, whether or not he spoke about it. Echad men ikar ksuba. One of them is called ikar ksuba. That's the 200 we spoke about. Vashar he nikroit tnai ksuba. The other ones have a lesser standing, and they're called tnai ksuba, which means elements of the ksuba, so to speak. The Elohein, Lirapoisem Cholsa, medical insurance. Liftoisem Nishbis. I want to just kind of make a statement about this. Usually, when a couple gets married, a young couple gets married, you know, the first time round and so on, these things seem to us obvious. But, and you know, I mean, obviously everything is kind of shared and so on. Usually that's not something people think about. But when there's a second marriage at an older age and people have different assets to start with, and then one of the sides gets zapped with a big medical bill, that's where, in fact, friction starts. You know, it's very few people are in a situation where they get married and they say, I don't care if my wife is sick. But when there's prior assets, so, I mean, why should I take care of that problem? Very few people are so mean to say, I don't mind if the person dies. But many people are, why should this person, he or she is a millionaire, let them take care of themselves. So he's obligated medical expenses, liftoisa nishpis, to bail her out if she's captured, lekavra kashetamus, funeral expenses. Let's say somebody dies, if a woman dies, and the husband says, I don't particularly care, let the community pay for it. The community can take it out of his assets. He's obliged. On the other hand, let's say somebody is a sibling, Chas v'Shalom dies, something like that, he's not obliged. The community might try sanctions if he can afford it and he wants it, but he's not. It's not an automatic obligation. If let's say the husband dies and she chooses not to cash in on her ksuba, she has the option to remain in the house, and as long as there are assets, she gets to live off the assets, you know, for daily expenses. So as long as she stays in the house, and she has the option of drawing out of the household As soon as she picks up a ksuba, she leaves. It's like a difference between a lump sum and an annuity. She has that choice. Any daughters that she has from him live off the estate until they become engaged. And then one more. V'liyos b'neho haschor mimenu yorshin k'subasa yasal chalkom b'yirushashim acheyem. This is something that's not really relevant to us. If somebody is married to two wives, so there's a bonus that he writes in the ksuba that your male children will get an extra part equivalent to the ksuba I'm writing to you. So if he particularly likes her and he gives her a very big ksuba, and she had died before, her male children will inherit a bigger portion of their estate than they would deserve as being sons, because their mothers, so this is relevant only when there are two wives or so. And, okay, so those are the 10 things that he's obligated to her. V'ha'arba, she'zoicha ben kulam divrei seifrim, the four that he gets, the Rabbanan made it. It's a counter takana to make sure, you know, nobody likes to feel, wow, I'm giving everything and there's nothing in return. So, li'os ma'isideh shaloi, anything that she earns under normal circumstances, if she works extra hard, and Chazal define it as something like beyond what per normal work, the money does not go to him, but normal salary goes to him. V'liyos mitzias shalav, she finds things, and everybody knows women always find mitzias. So that's, and except most of them we don't particularly care for, so I'm not sure that we're. V'shia oichel kol peres chaser b'chayeha. This is a very important piece. We'll go back to it in a second. V'meisa b'chayev yoshana, and if she dies while he's alive, he's the one who inherits her. V'kodem kol miyusha. It was not to have been that way. In the Torah, a husband and wife do not have, they don't inherit each other. The Rabbanan made, because there's so much of his assets coming in, that's why they made it that way. Before I explain, I want to do four. The oitik nechachamim, a final phase is, sheyu maisi deo isha keneged mezonoseho, upidyoyne keneged achaz perseo, ukevasa keneged achaz kubasa. Chazal gave the woman an added benefit. And they said, let's say a woman comes in and she's a real mutzlachas. She earns $500,000 a year. And he's not such a mutzlach and he earns $100,000 a year. So he'll say, don't worry, darling, I'll take care of you, I'll support you. Here's $10,000 for support. I want your salary of $500,000. Chazal said she has the right to call it. She can say, yes, I'd like to be supported, and anything I earn will go to you. Or she can say, Tumishkin Tavis, keep your $100,000. I'll take care of my finances, take care of your finances. And so she has the option in all of these three cases to call it and to say which one she wants. I want to go back to that piece we skipped, because that's going to be critical in another point also. He says he can eat the peres of an echasim in her life, which brings us to another element called nadun, nidunya, dowry. The way it's written in the Gemara, the way it's spoken about, is slightly different than what we assume. The dowry is as follows: a woman comes into marriage with assets. Let's say she has a pickup truck. A kind of tomboyish lady. She has a pickup truck that you can use for deliveries and schlepping stuff and so on and so forth. If she brings it into the marriage, it's written up. It's written into the ksuba. Not practically, we'll see about what our ksuba looks like, but it's sort of written in, and there are two arrangements that the rabbis envisioned that he can choose to be fair about it. So let's say she comes into marriage with a fleet of taxi cabs. And he then, if she brings that into the marriage, in other words, that's part of what makes her very, very attractive shidduch. I can see in a resume, you know, these miles, a fleet of 25 cabs. The husband, though, he can use it for business while they're married. And he can make use of it. So let's take something that's more Jewish than taxi cabs, houses. She comes from a very nice real estate family, and she comes in with 25 apartment buildings. If she brings it into the marriage, she presents it as such, he can now take the rent. That becomes income for him. However, there are two ways in which he ensures that the assets don't remain his. One arrangement is called nichse milug. That's the most common arrangement. When the marriage is over, whether because of divorce or widowhood, then you get the buildings back as they are. They may have gone up in value. You know, it might have been an outlying farm someplace, and today it's in town. Real estate tends to be that way, and the appreciation becomes hers. On the other hand, it could depreciate. Building that's been used for a long time, it is worth a lot less, and the depreciation is hers. That's called nichse milug. There's a second arrangement called nichse tzon barzel, which means iron sheep, steel sheep. He says, let's evaluate what it was. It's worth, those buildings are worth $10 million. When the marriage is over, you get $10 million back. If the housing went up, I gained, my estate gained. If the housing went down, you gained. So those are two arrangements. But this is another element in the finances of the marriage. The asset she brings in as a bonus to the marriage, so that he can use it for business and development and so on and so forth. He insures it. The default insuring is nichse milug, that as whatever the value is when the marriage is over, that's what you get. Or he can do it somebody else. Those are the basic elements of the finances between a husband and a wife. The 200 and the 100, whether you wrote the main part of the ksuba, those 200 zuz, whether you wrote it or you didn't write it, it's there. It's automatic. That's very important to remember. It doesn't make a difference if you gave her a ksuba or not. These are the obligations. All of these elements, he also may add money, which is, let's say he particularly wants to show his affection for her, and he says, I want to add another 1,000 zuz. He may do that. Obviously, it's not automatic. B, the nadin part, what it is that she brought into the marriage zone, is obviously also not automatic, because there's no way to know what, when, and how. But the other things, whether you write it or not, it's automatic. The rabbis felt that a woman is still not comfortable with the idea that it's automatic. People like to see things in writing. What's right in some abstract sense, that he's going to have to give you X, Y, or Z, people don't feel so comfortable with it. The technical lashon is like somcha daita. She's not comfortable with it. So the Chachamim said, you need to give it in writing. And if you don't give it in writing, you're not going to live with her. It's actually a problem. Sometimes a woman loses a ksuba, so technically they shouldn't even have yichud until they write a new ksuba. There are b'di'avad eitzes what to do, but it's happened, a friend of mine was Masadik Dushin. He got a frantic phone call at some weird hour in the morning that she can't find the ksuba, and she doesn't know where it is, and she's at a wit's end, because at a chasna, everybody's thinking about everything but the ksuba. So she gave it to her mother gave it to the daughter to hold, the daughter gave it to her best friend, and the best friend put it down with the presents and forgot this and gave Ace where it is. It's a problem. It's a very big problem, because halachically you're not allowed to be misyachid with your wife without a ksuba. Chazal say, because the woman doesn't feel that commitment without a ksuba, it's almost like it would be znus. It's almost as if it would be a casual relationship. Very fascinating. But that, as it is the ksuba the way it is in principle. Is that what's in writing by us? And the answer is no. And let's take a look at page 6. Page 6 is a very, very not fancy ksuba. Let's call it an unadorned, bare minimum, no frills ksuba. I guess different marriages call for different styles, and this is the words of the ksuba, the way they are, the way we have it, without all this stuff. Fine. On page 7 and 8, what I did was I paragraphed it. In other words, I divided it into paragraphs and of meaning. In other words, there's 13 different points which are important and meaningful. I'm not going to go in order. I want to start with the main part and then work our way backwards to see it more from its structure point rather than the sequence of the words. Let's take a look at page... Let's take a look at number 2. Let's say 2. Eich shabocho Yaakov ben Yitzchak shechia omolo lado psul teroch vasam. The things in black letters are the things that vary from suba suba. The names, the dates, etc. Eich shabocho Yaakov ben Yitzchak omolo lado psul teroch vaslovan. I use names simply because it's, we can get the sense of whose father, whose son, really easy. Shetichia. Havlu le'intug das moist of Yisrael. A bocher Yaakov Yitzchak told a psula, Rachel Baslovin, I would like you to be my wife in accordance with Jewish law. Now, what's he promising? 3. Vano, I eflach ve'oikir ve'ezen v'afanes asechi lechi. I will, eflach means to work the fields, like in modern falahin, fedahin is, a falach is to work, Arab peasants who work the land are called falachin. Ve'oikir, I will respect. Ve'ezen va'farnes yasechilchi, I will provide you with parnasa. Kehilches guven yudoyin, as is the halacha, or as the norm for Jewish husbands. The falchin, they work u'moikrin v'zonim farnes Hashem bekushta. They honestly support and respect their wives. This actually is not as simple as it looks, and it's discussed in halacha the following way. Certainly, we saw that any money you earn needs to go to her support. In other words, a person is working as an accountant, and he brings in $100,000 a year, he has to be Mephinus' wife, like that we saw, for it's one of the ksuba. There's no question about that. Let's say he's an accountant, and there's no work for an accountant. And instead, he's basically doing nothing. He's drifting. He lives off occasionally people invite him for a cup of coffee and a donut. You know, everyone's got their own alternative lifestyle. He likes it. His wife says, get a job and bring home money. Does she have a taina? Can she force him halachically to do that or not? If he earns money, he says, can she force him to go around collecting for her? Say, okay, it's very nice people invite you for coffee and donuts, but it's, you know, make the rounds and bring home money so that I also have coffee and donuts. It's a halachic shaila, and some feel that the implication of the ksuba, that the ezer and farnes, a falach is the normal lifestyle where a person is a farmer, and he works the fields, and the produce is his wife as much as she needs, you know, to live and so on. But the addition of ezer and farnes, many poskim feel that the implication of that is like the shita that you're obliged to do something proactively. Even if it's not something you want to do, even if it's not something in your line of work, even if it's not the kavadik, whatever it is, you have to proactively. That's a shaila that's arisen, and some want to, so that's one. So one is this working and being a financer. 4. V'yahivna lechi moab sulaychi kesev zuzi mosen dechazin reisa. And I have given you this dowry, the moab sulaychi, which is kesef zuzi in silver zuz mosen 200. The reason why 200 is black is because if it's an almana it would be 100. The chazelichimidaraisa that the Torah entitles you to. This actually is something which is not black and white. We just saw before that many opinions, if not most, hold that ksuba is a drabbanan. So what does it mean that you deserve midoraisa? Sfardim do not have that ksuba. It doesn't say, I have a Sfardic ksuba in the back also. I have some, there are some interesting ksubas here. It doesn't say the chazilichi midoraisa because it's a drabbanan. So let me tell you what the Ramah says, and it's very significant. What are the differences? We're not Karaites. So what the rabbi said is as good for us as what the Torah said. We most of the things we do, most of the religious activities we do, if all 7 days except for the first day is Rabbanan. Davening is Rabbanan. Baruch Hashem, we keep Rabbanan. The difference is the value. Any monetary obligation the Torah, the Zuzim used, are worth 8 times as much as what's used for Rabbanan. That's a standard. Anytime Rabbi's Pidyon HaBen uses a higher standard, and things that are Rabbanan uses a lower standard. It's a certain type of coin that was used. So the Ramah says, even though we paskin that the obligation is rabbinic, we hold lahalacha that the value is a deraisa value. So this is one point of interesting discussion in Paskin. To give you a sense of how little the ksuba is worth, and it's a problem. So this is sort of the core of the ksuba. It's saying, I'm giving you more psyche. How much is 200 zuz worth today? So the kalal is, in all Torah monetary standards, one of the tricky things is, what is the monetary standard? I remember I was in Israel in 1970, and there was always, the shekel was always dropping. It wasn't a shekel, it was called the lira. And the lira was always dropping. In those days, they had an artificial exchange rate, which was set by the government. There wasn't a free market. There was a flourishing black market, which is always, whenever the government sets things, there's always a great black market. So it was set, when I came to Israel, I think it was 3 lira to a dollar. On the black market, it got to be 5 or 6. And then the government would make an announcement that they are now devaluing the lira, but they're going to be terribly, terribly strict with all the black market people. And, you know, this was a game that is always, the lira was always dropping, this and that. Some Israeli comedian said, I don't say the Americans, he said, the lira is such a stable currency. The dollar, every day, it's a different price. It's higher and higher. He says, it doesn't have the stability of the Israeli lira. We need a standard. What is money? The Torah considers kesef, silver, to be money. And kesef is kesef, you know, and then there's a reason why money is called silver. The reason probably was silver was a precious metal, but much more common than gold. Gold was very hard to make coins out of gold. It was very rare, very expensive. You know, you can't carry around a $100,000 bill in your pocket. So gold is too rare and too expensive to be considered currency. Currency needs to have some flow. Silver was the right metal, and that created, and that was used as currency. So the Gemara actually debates it, whether silver or gold is the standard, Gemara Bar Metzia. At the end of the day, we hold silver as a standard, and everything we do is by silver. The problem is today, we're not linked to silver. And the value of silver, we know the amount, it's a weight, and we know it in grams and in ounces. The approximate value today of a ksuba for bidra rabbanan is something like $120. And if it's 8 times that, it's $960. It fluctuates from day to day, a few pennies one way or another way, but that's just to give you a frame, which really created a problem. I mean, how much is $120 a deterrent to getting divorced? I remember, I have children who live in Far Rockaway and in Lawrence, and this, whenever we drive back on the Rockaway Turnpike, there's a big sign, divorces starting at $239. And we always laugh, say, Metzia, it's not much of Metzia, for $239. Yeah. But Lemaisa, it's a problem.
Did you say before that it has to be the amount of food for a year?
That's what it was. But the takana was 200 zuz. And the problem is the intention and the application are actually two different things. There was a movement from the Rabbanut in 1945 in Israel to change it and to add a certain value. There was tremendous reluctance from Moshe Rabbeinu, Brisker Rav especially. He felt that one should not change things that are set, you know, like a ksuba. That's not the way to go with it. In other words, to make changes in the 200 sots itself, he was very against. And what some people did was they add to it, which we can. We can add to it with Tosefis and get the same effect. Yes?
It would be like the inflation adjusted. Whatever the equivalent, the gentleman said,
begs the question, what the standard is. Inflation adjusted, so if the standard was a few, you know, X amount of bread and herring and so on and so forth, that would be true. The problem is, the Chazal said it in silver. So even though what we're adjusting it is to silver. So if silver goes up or down, the ksuba goes up or down, and it stops being a deterrent. It's a problem. Okay, that's one element. There's another element. Let's look at 7. We write it one more thing. V'dein nedunya dan olas lemi be'avua. And she brought in assets from her father's house. Bein bekesev, bein mezonot, achshitim, mimona levusha. Bein bekesev, whether silverware, goldware. Bein betachshitim, jewelry. Bimona levusha, clothing. Bishimusha dira, furnishings of the house. Bishimusha ta'arsa, or bed, you know, stuff for the bedroom, etc. Hakol kibbal of Yaakov chasan dinan, b'meyas kukin kesev tzarev. The Chassan has evaluated it and given us, we spoke before about how much money do you owe when she leaves. So he has now accepted it upon himself. Me'a skukim kesef tzarf. The word skukim, people make a big mistake. They think it means pure. I don't know what it means. The skukim is the name of a type of currency. The currency of skukim was one of the earliest versions of the mark, the German mark. And it was called skukim because it was the mark in pure silver. It was called marka, I forgot the Latin word for silver, if somebody knows it. I think it's printed in one of these places here.
Argenti.
Yeah, marka argenti. It was called the silver mark, and it was the pure version. So zakuk is the name of a currency. So he said, okay, I also owe you 100 zakuk for whatever you bring in. 100 zakuk is not an insignificant amount. Depending, it's a machlokas chazanish, Avram Chayanoia, it varies between something like $15,000 to $15,000 to $25,000, approximately, depending on the different ways of reckoning the shear. That's not an insignificant amount. Besides which, that's one half. V'tzavi Reb Yaakov chasan denan, and Reb Yaakov our chasan, the word tzavi means desired, wished. V'hoisif la, he was gracious and added another 100. V'hoisif delay oid me'askukim kasef tzaref, acherim, kinegdon. He said, you know what? You were so nice. You brought in such a nice dowry. I'm giving you a bonus, another 100. Sacha kol masayim skum gezitzar. 200. So now the sum is something between 35,000 to 50,000, depending on which shita. So that is the standard Ashkenazi sums that write in. This nusach, even though she may have brought in a house that's worth a lot more than that, or she may not even brought in that, that's become the standard. In the Ashkenazi ksubas, this is the standard. We don't vary it. If a person wants to add more, then we write it on a separate piece of paper and as a separate shtar. We don't change it. The Sfardim, we'll see maybe if we have a few minutes time, the Sfardim do actually write in the amount. They also sometimes haggle at the wedding. It's a very, very, it's a mark of covet. My daughter, she's not a Jewish princess, she's a Jewish queen. And less than $1 million, low baba cheshbon. I was at a wedding once, The boy was Chassidish, the girl was Sephardi, actually. And at the chuppah, I was a young boy. I was in yeshiva. I was 17, 18. And I couldn't believe it. There was screaming and yelling and going back and forth. Reb Chaim Shulevitz was a Sadek Dushan. Reb Chaim Shulevitz was very wise. He heard both sides, nodded, and then he made some sort of compromise. He actually couldn't hear Reb Chaim, but he was very smart. He knew how to nod and tell this side, they're right, they're right. And he wrote in an amount, and that's it. The problem with it is, actually, there was a case in Rabbanut. So, you know, at a wedding, it's just a question of half a million, you know, my... Da, 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 da. But God forbid, if you break up, what happens? And there was a story in the Rabbanut in Israel. Somebody got divorced from his wife. He remarried. Some smart friend of his said, you want to get back at your first wife? I've got a great idea. Write a million shekel. Like, you know, just flaunt it in her face. So he listened to the wise words of his friend, wrote a million shekel. Then he realized he should have stayed with his first wife. And his first wife wanted him back. He wanted back. And his second wife wasn't thrilled with him either. But she said, we've got a written contract. Give me a little shekel. He said, nah, I didn't mean it. I just meant to taunt my first wife. And the Rabbanut said, no way. And it's sometimes, I think Rav Yosef has said, it came out against people who write these to show off, because God forbid, if there is a tragic situation, you don't want this to become another bone of contention. Just usually, in Beis Din, they will usually try to work out some, they're not going to go with the letter of the Ksuba, they'll try to work out something reasonable that will include the needs of both sides. But still, this is the basis. Let's just briefly, you know, go through some of the other points. So this is really those are the main points of what you're obliging. Let me just mention, five was, I will give you mezonaychik susaychik zipukaychik, which is sheyak susan ona, food, clothing, and needs, or male of a sechor klara, live together as is usual. Six is she wanted. She agreed to that. Seven is we spoke about bringing in this naden, this extra money. Eight is the tosefis. Nine is simply what he says is that all of his property that he has and will have are attached to provide for the ksuba. In other words, any property he has is a lien on his present property and future property to be able to pay up the ksuba. 10 is that the chassan is aware of the fact that this is a real obligation and it's not just kind of sort of written just for the heck of it, kind of, but it's a real obligation. 11 is an important piece. Many of you don't see, there's something that goes on in the ksuba behind the scenes, so to speak. It's done either at the tnoyim in our weddings here, or at the chuppah itself in Eretz Yisrael, or by Sfardim. The chassan is mekabel a kinyan. In other words, he makes a kinyan, like by Mechiras Chametz. They give him a handkerchief, and he lifts it up, and that becomes a kinyan chalipin. Why does he need that kinyan for? What's that there for? He's obliged anyway. The Torah obliged him, and so on. So there are two reasons why you need to make a kinyan. So in Masada Kedushin, in American weddings, the custom is to do it before the tanoim. When you're filling out the tanoim and the ksuba, the chassan is there. You bring over two witnesses, and the witnesses actually, when the witnesses sign an ksuba, what they're saying in a shtar in the Torah is a declaration by the witnesses. We have witnessed the fact that so-and-so has voluntarily obliged himself with this and this. We need it for the extra, for the 100 and 100, that the obligation is created by his being mekabel kinyan. Without that, there is no obligation. The first 200 is obliged no matter what. It's not going to help him anything. But the second 200, secondly, there's another technical point that's very important. This happens at chasnas certain times of the year. Halachically, if you predate a shtar, it is invalid. Post-dating is not a problem. So for instance, let's say I borrow $1,000 from you and I give you a shtar that's dated a day early. That shtar is worthless, because what I could do is I could go and collect from properties that you had sold before, as if I had retroactively attached your property. You can't do that. So those shtars are terrible shtars. It's called the shtar muktam, and you are and the obligation and it doesn't, it's null and void, and it's wrong to hold such a shtar because you're holding potentially a fraudulent document. The document says you can collect all properties that were his on a certain date, and you can't. You're not allowed to hold a shtar like that. You have to burn it because it's as if you're holding a forged check in your possession. What happens sometimes at chasna is you write the ksuba, you write today's date, you're sitting at 5 in the afternoon, it gets fashlep, the photographer's not here, the musician didn't tune his guitar yet, the flower girls are nowhere to be found. By the time you get around, it's after the shkia. Or if it's a Kohavim. He's handing her a shtar. So they're getting married the next day, not Thursday. They're getting married Friday. He's handing her a ksuba dated on Thursday. That's a pasul ksuba. Not only is it pasul, not allowed to hold a ksuba like that. We get around it because he can oblige himself even when he's not married if he's makabel kinyan. Just like I can oblige myself to give you $1,000, and when I make the kinyan, that's when it's chal. We tell the chassan, this is one thing Masechet Kedushin does, tell the chassan, listen, no matter when the chuppah is, so if it's 12 o'clock, you're not choshish, it's going to go till 6 o'clock and before the chuppah. But like sometimes during the year, when it's touch and go, you know, in the winter, you do everything after the shkia because it's very late. You know, it's very early, the night's early. In the summer, in the long days, but sometimes the times of the year when I know the problems are going to happen, is 7:30 when you write, or 6:30 or something when you write the ksuba, it's going to be before shkia, and the chuppah will be afterwards. So the kinyan makes that happen before. Okay, I just want to go through some of the things we have here. Those are the basic elements of the ksuba.
Right.
There are, yes.
From something you said before.
Sure.
The woman going into the marriage had the option of not declaring her assets and not.
Yes. Yes. She has. Yeah. 100%. It's just seen as being. In the game, in the marriage game, it seemed to be advantageous if she has assets that she can bring into the marriage. It makes her more desirable. You know, it's yes.
In the ksuba, does the woman obligate herself anything to the man?
No. The obligations that she has are there, notwithstanding, and the husband doesn't need. Like we said before, the getting it in writing is more for the woman's peace of mind than it is for anything. So, like we said in the Rambam in the beginning, he has 4 privileges as regards her assets, but you don't write it out. And as we saw, we don't write out Naksuba many of the points the Rambam says, because it's assumed, it's there. We write out the main points that we want her to have a document so that she feels comfortable, certain security level. Just so that for your information, the things I added, so that you'll have it. Page 9 is a Hebrew translation of the Aramaic Ksuba. Page 10 is the Ksuba for a divorcee, which is the main difference is you must write in, if you'll take a look, like on the 4th line, it says, Amalo lahadom matrachta. By the way, all of these are taken from a sefer called Ksuba Kilchasa. It's a Dayan in Bnei Brak. It was the easiest place to get it off the Yotza Chachma. You say, Ladom Matrachta, this divorced woman. It's important to write it because in case she'll ever want to marry a Kohen, let's say her second husband dies, everybody says, oh, she's an Almana, she can marry a Kohen. We need to make sure that the Ksuba is also our most basic source of information about the status of the woman. Page 11 is a ksuba. If you find out that the first ksuba had a mistake in it, had to correct it. Let me explain something. You can't just write another ksuba because you can't hold 2 ksubas. You're not allowed to hold 2 ksubas because in a certain sense it gives her a possibility of collecting twice. So we have to write in the fact that it's... So we had a whole Megillah here. That's 11. Page 12 is if you lose a ksuba. That's an important ksuba. So if you're doing a Pesach cleaning and you find everything in the world in the house except for the ksuba. So if you really can't find the ksuba, you have to go to the Rav and write a ksuba. And this is the nusach. It's called Shtar Ksuba de Irkasa.
The Irkasa means lost.
Lost, yes, correct. Page 13 is very interesting. Page 13 and 14 are Sfardi ksubas. Sfardi ksubas are... they have the modern Sephardic Subis have a whole bunch of things in the beginning, like a lot of psukim and nice things. That's obviously meaningless; it doesn't make a difference. But some interesting features of it are there's some variation in the spelling, which is not nothing. Let's see. You see where the two where they have the two blank lines, like sach va'ola sach hakol bar masayin zuzin dechazlu atnoyim sheista b'neim dechazlu lo. It's about, I'd say a third of the way down, 40% of the way down on the right hand side, right under the word sach. Yeah. So he says hatnoyim sheista b'neim shriim v'kayomin kitnayim neigod meiruvin. All of the things they've agreed upon and finances that's been agreed on is chal. The Elohein Meiser de Aloy Mizoni Chotzacholov. It itemizes somebody's obligations. The Tzacholov Hadira Be. The house in this place is the house they're going to live in. Hayerushik Fiaskama Hanahuga Beakadish Shalim Tarim Bainin. The inheritance is going to be the way it's normally done in Yerushalayim. You know, it happens to be written in Yerushalayim, this one. V'lo yisa v'lo yeshadach le'yikadesh shum ishacher soleho. He won't marry a second wife. Sfardim never accepted Rabbi Gershom's cherem. So he might surprise her for the anniversary and bring home another wife. And that's not a good surprise. So he says, v'lo yisa v'lo yeshadach le'yikadesh shum ishacher soleho. He won't marry or even... attempt to marry another woman ke'imbershus beznat tzedek without the express permission of bezn. The reason.
Not written in the ksuba, you could do it.
What?
If it's not written in the ksuba, you could do it without
Sfardim,
her
ksuba. Sfardim,
without her ksuba,
there's no cheren of benegeshem. A person can marry to wise maker adin, and teimanim. My wife remembers when she was a young girl. Her mother had an ozeret, a cleaning lady, a Yemenite cleaning lady, very nice, who was one of two wives. And they actually got along. You know, she would say, oh, I have to pick up something for my other wife. That was her. On the other hand, there was somebody in the mirror, a Persian, who was one of two wives. And it was a horrible, horrible arrangement, a very, very difficult arrangement. But so you write in Mefurish that he can't do it. V'lo yefateno, v'lo yesiteno. He won't try in any way to seduce her, convince her, incite her, to forego any part of ksuba. He's not going to pressure her into releasing him of any ksuba. Not some of it, not all of it, and nothing of the ksuba. And if she will forfeit any of it, it is... not valid. In other words, we're now stating that there is that any forfeiting that she does is not acceptable. One more interesting piece that is very controversial, but most Sfardim, many Sfardim do it. Let's look about four lines from the bottom. It says the chasen was kind of with a kinyan, like we spoke about. V'gam nishpa hachasen shvur chamura. The chassan swore an oath, but tkias kaf is a handshake, halachically has somewhat the status of an oath. So he's taken upon himself, and they actually in some places do it, in some places are vehement against it, by Sfardim. They don't. Aldas ha-mokim baruch hu, the swearing by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'aldas ha-nishpoim be'emes, la'ashach ha-chassan suba, that is, belishum t'shiri t'vura t'vura klas, so he swears, he obligates himself with a shvuah that he will uphold the ksuba and not attempt to change the meaning or intention, whatever it is. That's very famous, and some Sfardim, that's a tradition, and today many Sfardim are against it because halachically it's a very, very difficult piece. And then they have one more point that's different. The last line, you write over here, the chas himself signs the ksuba. Halachically, the signing of witnesses is better than signing yourself. It's an additional kind of, you can't find the witnesses, you don't know, you can't locate them, you can't identify the handwriting, validate it. The problem it creates halachically is as follows, that if you have three people signed as witnesses, and one of them is not a good witness, he's a cousin, a relative, a minor, it invalidates all witnesses. In other words, it's a package deal. If there's a problem with one of them, all of it goes. So the chas himself cannot be a witness. He can be the party, he's the principal, but he's not a witness. So adding his signature, unless it's very clearly designated as a separate entity, is problematic. The second side, if you'll take a look, is also Sfardi, Ksuba. Without the piece that's different is, it does not have the part about a Shavua and a Tkias Kaf, because that's the Sfardim, and most today is the ones that don't do it. They're the ones who actually are, you know, it's becoming dominant today that not to do it, it's the rice, it's a very terrible thing to swear Shavua, even if you mean it, and so on. So most of them leave it out. When I got married, the ksuba I used was from the Eid Achredes Yerushalayim. They had two things that today we don't have. They had the chasen signing, which today no ksubas have a chasen signing. And I don't say no, but I say that's fallen out, certainly by the Ashkenazim. They also had a condition that you can't leave Eretz Yisrael without your wife being maskim. That was sort of Eid Achredes as the guardian of Eretz Yisrael, kind of. I think that that's also not something many people do. Right? People stick to the old nusach. Just, I guess, to finish off one more thing. The standard, the safer that is most accepted for the validity of ksubas, in other words, the reference, the point of reference for the difference in nusach and so on, is a safer called Nachlas Shiva. Nachlas Shiva, we have it, they put it out now in a very nice edition of three volumes. Nachlas Shiva is like, it's sort of the handbook for writing any halachic shtar. He doesn't have only ksuba, he has 40, 50 different shtaras, business deals, hete iskes, tnoim rishonim, tnoim achronim, every combination that you could think of, his is the standard. It's like the Mishubura, his is the Nachlas Shiva, it's written about 200 somewhat years ago. He also explains each point. In other words, each point that he has that is not clear, he sort of goes through the issues and the halachas and so on and so forth. That's today, when people say they have a ksuba, nachas shiva ksuba, that's what they mean.
Who is the
Mechaber? I forgot his name, but he's an Aachen of about 200 years ago. Very, very famous. What?
In Europe.
Yeah, in Europe. Like, 200 years ago, nothing in America, I assure you. Not even Washington, D.C. What? Yeah. That's the gold standard, so to speak, of ksubas. And again, there's always room for some variation. I also added over here, page 16, 17, from 15 onwards, there's a wonderful sefer written by a big Talmud Chacham. His name is Reb Chaim Banush. He's a contemporary, somebody living. He's actually a Gera Chassid, a big Talmud Chacham, and a very big scholar, actually. And he has written a Sfarim on the standards in the Torah. Weights, measures, values of coins, time. He is extremely thorough, very, very extraordinary, good sefer, two good sefer. Zmanim and Midos and Mishkalos. He has here, he goes through the Zokuk, how much it's worth, how much it weighed, the machlokes and so on. It's just for information. It's a very, very good, it's an excellent sefer. He also brings, for instance, it's my page 16 on the left-hand column, he brings the first quote that in Ashkenaz we have a standard nusach for how much money you brought in, and so on and so forth. He has the best, he's very, very good source material. And what? On page 17, he also has The Ravan, who is very, very early Ashkenazi, Rishon, who was the first one to write that V'omda v'senu shalem v'zeh ha-malchus. The reason why we have the standard nusa for how much you add and how much dowry you evaluate it is, they said people were very sensitive. A poor caller comes into a marriage with $100 worth of assets, you're not going to embarrass her and write she only came with $100 of assets and that's all she has. So we write a standard nusach. If anybody has extra and really stuff of real value, he you add it afterwards. Any questions? Any?
Yes. From the Alaflor, Sefer Flor in Maseches Ketubos.
Yeah.
He says something very nice about the words.
That, by the way, it's his great-great-grandfather, I believe. No, you're from that family? You're not from that family.
We're not from that family, but we're from
okay,
the
Okay, yeah, he was a Horowitz. Yes. Yeah, okay.
So he writes in Akdome that the word Ksuva,
yeah,
he says, because it says that Ish and Isha is Yud-K.
Right.
Shon Beinem, Shechina Beinem is right. The Yud-K. He says,
yeah, they have it earlier than him. The Arizal says that they have it early. I've seen that quoted early, yes. Okay, good. Beseder Gemar.
I'm sorry, who is
the father of this sefer? This sefer is a Yid of Chaim Banish. Banish. We have it in Yeshiva, based on Vavshin. He wrote one, he's written a few really extraordinary sefer. He's very clear and very organized and really knowledgeable. So he has one, it's called Shi'urim Mishkolos of the Torah. That's his Midas of Shura Torah. He has one on time, on different zvanim. He put out a recent one on Chassidus, very good. In other words, the main ideas and things of Chassidus in Sfas Emes, he's a Geras, so it's mostly that. He has one on the Agadah, very, very pshat and very well constructed. So, okay, good.